Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, let's start with the current hype tour on Bidenomics, the latest expression of which is in the last couple of days, the history or the one-year history of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. This was the third of three acts that were passed in 2022 by Congress, proposed by Biden. These are Biden administration acts. The other two were the infrastructure bill turned into an act. I think that was in the final month of 2021, taking effect in 22, and then the so-called Semiconductor Chips and Manufacturing Act, and then I think that was August of 22, and then we had, that was before that, and then we had the Inflation Reduction Act, three acts passed by Congress. And today, not today, but yesterday, I think it was, a big hype in the White House, Biden declaring the Inflation Reduction Act was such a great bill here. Hillary Clinton jumped on board and said it turbocharged U.S. manufacturing, Inflation Reduction Act. Oh, yeah, that's why U.S. manufacturing has been contracting 9 months in a row now. Yeah, quite a turbocharge in the wrong direction, maybe. By the way, you know, this Inflation Reduction Act name had nothing to do with inflation. And in fact, I think Biden even mentioned, he's sorry that he titled it Inflation Reduction. But, you know, that's what's coming out of Congress in the last couple of decades. All these bills, they try to label them with a title that has nothing to do with them. I used to be mostly a job creation act. So all these big tax cuts for businesses were called job creation acts, right? As if you cut taxes, the money, extra money, is going to be used by business to invest in investment and expansion and create jobs, which doesn't, of course, happen. The money gets hoarded or it's used to buy back stock or it goes offshore or something like that. So all these job creation acts are just phony titles. And Inflation Reduction Act was a phony title as well. Nothing to do with inflation reduction. And in fact, what these three bills in 2022 become acts were really about was transferring unspent funding from the COVID era plus new funding into business, into investment, subsidies for business investment. That's what these three bills were. And they totaled $1.65 trillion. Inflation Reduction Act was part of that. $1.65 trillion shifted in 2022 by the Biden administration from household support, COVID and related, and tuition and child care, and et cetera, and shifted to businesses. Big income transfer to stimulate business investment. Well, the problem with business investment is that the money, as I just said, doesn't really flow much of it into actual real investment. It flows into financial asset markets by these companies buying back their stock, paying out record multi-trillion-dollar annual dividend and stock buyback plans. Yeah, for a decade now, over $1 trillion to Fortune 500 companies. In some cases, like $1.5 trillion in combined dividend payouts and stock buybacks. You know, whether it's stock tax cuts, you know, a lot of it goes there, or whether you get government spending money, like these three acts, a lot of it goes into returning the money to their rich stockholders. Or the companies themselves hoard it, or they use it to invest themselves themselves in stocks and bonds and financial assets, or they send it offshore to their subsidiaries, et cetera, you know. That's why we're not seeing much real growth in recent decades here of business investment in the real economy. So, you know, $1.65 trillion, that's what went to corporations in these three acts, three bills, right? The chip, semiconductor chip bills, I think it's $480 billion. $52 billion of that alone is a direct bribery and subsidy to semiconductor companies, largely to get them to try to relocate back to the U.S., but also to bribe other foreign semiconductor companies like TSMC or in Taiwan and German companies to relocate to the U.S. As well. And that's all part of this preparation for economic war. Well, it is economic war, but for a hot war within 10 years with China, you know, get these key tech companies out of the way and get them back safely to North America. You know, and to the extent they come back to North America, I think a lot of them are going to come back to Mexico rather than to the U.S. And then use NAFTA as a free trade zone to move the stuff across the border. That's the role of free trade, you know. Yeah, $1.65 trillion slush fund here for businesses. Now, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act did provide some subsidies and incentives, tax cuts and subsidies for so-called environmental investment. But it's just a toe in the water. It's not enough, and it's not coming online fast enough. You know, on that topic, we're supposed to have had a goal of holding global warming to 1.5 centigrade by the end of the decade. Well, we hit that last month. Yeah. Not too much said about that, but the global temperature up 1.5 centigrade in July. And it's getting warm. I mean, Canada's burning. Northern Canada is burning up. Well, all across Northern Canada. Right. Oh, well, that's global warming and drying out of the boreal forest up there. And, you know, when they're not talking about what this global warming in the tundra is really doing to thawing out the tundra and the release of methane gas that's going on now, worse than the forest fires. Yeah, methane is like, what, 10 or 40 times worse than CO2. Yeah, and that's probably being released in massive amounts now across northern Canada and Alaska and Siberia, massive amounts. And they're not talking about that. And that means they lost control of the whole global warming. I think they've lost control of global warming. And this Inflation Reduction Act, to the extent that it provides a couple hundred billion dollars for alternative energy, and a couple hundred billion dollars probably at the same time, thanks to Joe Manchin, for fossil fuel, you know, that was the price of getting that alternative energy investment in that act passed. Joe Manchin ensured that his buddies in the fossil fuel industry got a big bite of that apple, too. So probably it's a push whether that investment is going to actually push the needle towards, you know, slowing global warming or not. The $1.65 trillion, yeah, and that's the Inflation Reduction Act, right? Yeah, subsidy for fossil fuels as well as some token alternative energy, nothing to do with inflation. But Biden, you know, in his White House address, touting this thing as part of his Bidenomics tour, you know, which is really about misrepresenting and falsifying the results of his economic policies and record. Yeah. The Inflation Reduction Act, he's touting that as controlling inflation. Even though he then says out of the other corner of his mouth. Well, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I regret that I called it Inflation Reduction Act. Well, and then he says, but it reduced inflation. Well, I mean, you can't have it both ways. Either you think it has something to do with inflation control or you don't. But anyway, he referenced inflation has come down from 8.3% a year ago to 3.2%. Yeah. Proof that the Inflation Reduction Act has worked. Well, it has nothing to do with it. But he did make the claim, and inflation, headline inflation, right? CPI, we're talking about the CPI, Consumer Price Index, right? Has come down to 3.2%, but actually it's rising again. You see, the month before it was 3%. Now it's 3.2%. And I've been predicting for some time in the last couple months that it's going to go up again. And it did go up again. Yeah, because you've got energy prices, gasoline prices going up again as globally Saudi Arabia and OPEC cut their supplies and U.S. Companies use as an excuse to raise gasoline prices at the pump. Well, that's going up. As I predicted, corporations would continue price gouging here in the U.S., and they are, particularly insurance companies and food processing companies and rent, management rent companies, you know, all those price gouging, they're raising, continuing to raise their prices. Insurance companies, auto insurance and so forth, you know, all double digit going up, continuing here. I predicted rents would continue to go up. They are. You know, you got inflation creeping back up. And most important, listen to this, most important, right? If you look at the total CPI, Consumer Price Index, right? It's composed of what's called goods, discrete things that you buy, you know, furniture, cars, and et cetera, right? Goods. And then there's services of various kinds, all kinds of services. Right. So what's happening with services? Right. Services are 80% of the economy are services. 20% of the economy are goods. 12% of that is manufactured goods. 8% is construction. Right. So 20% of the economy is goods and 80% of the economy is services. Well, they're saying, oh, inflation is 3.2% because goods inflation have come down. Goods inflation, prices for manufactured goods have come down. Remember, we had all the supply chain problems. Well, they've come down and they're pretty much flat, except for housing, which is going back up. Right. So they're pretty much flat. But that may be due to the slowing global economy. Right? How much of that is due to slowing global economy? How much is due to Fed interest rate hikes over the past 15 months, no one is separating out the two effects. But, you know, let's admit, goods inflation has come down. But it's only 20% of the economy. Services inflation is stuck at over 6% for the last 3 months. They can't get the cost of services, inflation in services, down, even though the Fed has raised interest rates record level in record time. And it's going to raise rates again. Next week, we'll have a show here on the Jackson Hole confab on monetary policy. The Fed holds this annual meeting where the academics and experts get together in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Nice, comfortable resort. And they talk about federal interest rate policies and so forth, right? But interest rates are going up again, no doubt. Because the Fed even sees in the CPI the fact that it's rising again, right? And it may continue to rise. And they're, I'm sure, aware that they can't get services inflation down by raising interest rates. You know, the whole strategy is to create enough unemployment that workers have no income and therefore they can't spend money, and that reduces demand for goods and services, and that brings down prices eventually. It's a demand-based strategy. But the problem is not simply demand. It's even more a case of supply side problems, and the Fed rates can't do anything about supply side. Nor can the Fed do anything about long-term interest rates, 30-year bonds and such, right? The Fed policies where they raise interest rate is they raise short-term rates, you know, the bills, 30, 60, 90 days, and the notes, you know, 1 year, 2 year. They raise those, and those become like a benchmark for other interest rates in the economy. The Fed really can't do much about long-term rates. That's determined by the global and U.S. economy conditions. But we do have another problem here with interest rates, and we'll talk about more of that and why they're creeping back up, and that is the Federal Reserve has to now finance multi-trillion dollars of treasury debt. They have to issue more and more treasury debt than ever before to cover, on the fiscal side, these massive deficits that are continuing. We're at $34 trillion total national debt. Yeah, $34 trillion. Deficits, annual deficits raise that debt level, and annual deficits are still running $1 to $1.5 trillion every year. Every year. They can't get it under control. So the Fed, though, has to get money somewhere to cover that $1 to $1.5 trillion deficit. What does it do? It sells bonds. And because we have this huge deficit and debt and rising interest rates are a way of attracting more borrowers to buy the treasury bonds, which also they have to do now because China is not buying as much. China, is, because of the economic war, China is trying to dump as quickly as it can, slowly but quickly, its accumulation of U.S. treasuries, right? I think it's only holds $850 billion in U.S. treasuries now. It used to hold well over $1 trillion, okay? So the fact you got less China buying of treasuries, and you got the Fed having to sell more treasuries to cover the rising deficit, means that what? The Fed is dumping more treasuries onto the market to sell. Well, that increases the supply of treasuries out there, which means increased supply, all things equal, you lower the price of treasuries, and that raises the interest rate because you got an inverse relationship between the price of bonds and the interest rate. So as the Fed floods the market with treasuries to cover the rising deficits and debt, what happens is supply increases, the price goes down, and interest rates go up. That's why long-term interest rates are going and are rising now. So there are two things driving the Fed, how the Fed drives interest rates on the short side, you know, bills and notes. It declares a rise in rates that it'll pay. And on the long end, funding the deficit causes rates to rise as well. And that means we're in a chronic if not continuing Fed rate hikes, which is going to continue in September. After that, we don't know. If it's not going to continue to raise, it's going to at least keep them high for a long time now. And that means if the Fed is paying more interest, right, the interest on the debt is rising. The U.S. federal debt is rising. In 2019, as I've said before, it deserves repeating, the total U.S. interest payment on the debt was like $250 billion or so a year. Now it's over $600 billion a year, and that's going to $900 billion pretty soon, just interest on the debt. Well, that's money that's being paid to investors. Because they're the ones who buy the government bonds, corporations and banks and shadow banks and rich individuals, you know, they're the ones who buy the bonds. So we got this huge interest payment going to the wealthy 1%, which is driving their share of wealth even higher. because of these policies, Fed policy and the fiscal policy, which are broken. Fiscal monetary policy in the U.S. is broken. Contradictions are abounding and intensifying. And both of them, the fiscal crisis and the monetary crisis, are exacerbating each other. Okay. So anyway, that sort of drifted me off of this whole Bidenomics tour and Inflation Reduction Act. But the point I was trying to make is that services inflation is not very responsive to interest rate hikes, even though those hikes are going higher. What we've seen, to summarize this huge rate pace increase here over the past 15 months, and services are stuck at 6%. And, you know, that's what Fed Chair Powell has been talking about for almost a year. Oh, we got to get more unemployment in services to reduce demand for services. Well, it's not happening. It's not happening. Job creation has been sort of stuck at 180, 190,000 a month. It's not going down. Well, why is it not going down? Well, a lot of these jobs are being converted from full-time to part-time, and it looks like you get net job creation because, you know, the Fed counts jobs. They don't count people employed. They count jobs. So it looks like they can't get, you know, the job creation numbers down from almost to 200,000 a month. Well, why is that? Well, that's because a lot of companies didn't really hire everyone back after, particularly big companies, manufacturing company, after COVID. They didn't hire them back. So they're already on a skeleton crew. They're not going to reduce even further, you know, the job numbers. That's part of the problem. Right? There's other issues why, explanations why the job numbers are still in the 200,000 range every month. But the point of it is the Fed can't generate the contraction in consumer demand that it thinks it needs in order to get demand-based inflation down. It's stuck, right? It's stuck, particularly services. It's stuck at around 6% the last 3 months. The CPI report in September is going to be very important. You know, will we see a continued drift upward in all items, CPI? Will we see in services inflation still stuck at 6%? Think about it. You know, you got this record Fed rate hike, and you get services inflation abating maybe a couple percent. You know, we had 8.3, now it's about 6.1, 6.2, whatever, services prices. You know, I mean, that's not enough to bring down services inflation. You know, I sometimes think that the Fed has forgotten its own history. You know, back in 81, we had chronic high inflation, about the same as we had in 21, 22, all right? And again, it was driven largely by supply-side forces back then. But the Fed had to shake out supply-side, services-side inflation. It had to raise interest rates, get this, to 15%. Well, we're at 5.5% right now and going up. That's a long way from 15. Well, that shook out inflation in 80-81, right? At a big price, because it really precipitated the worst contraction in the economy since the Great Depression. You know, that was the Reagan recession, 80-81. And pretty much shut down construction and autos and other goods. Made workers pay the price for Saudi Arabia and Iran energy supply problems. And, you know, it worked at a great cost, But now the Fed can't do that. You know, the Fed can't raise rates to 15%. The economy under neoliberalism has changed in the last 40 years. we've had this extensive financialization and globalization and services industry replacing the bulk of manufacturing as offshoring and manufacturing occurred since Reagan. So the economy has changed, and they can't get as much bang for the buck when they raise interest rates, particularly in services. Contradictions in Fed monetary policy. If they raise it because of financialization of the economy in the last 40 years, if they raise it 6% and above, we're going to see even greater banking system, financial system instability. We already are beginning to see it with the regional banking crisis, interest rate risks, right? 5.5% that I predicted last year would happen. Well, what happens if they try to raise it to 10-15%? Well, the whole financial system is going to crash. And they know it. So the Fed can't do what it did in 80-81 to get prices down that it has to do if it wants to get prices down in the services. Big contradiction, you see. You know, monetary policy, interest rate policy is ineffective. It doesn't produce economic growth when you lower rates to zero, which they did for like 8-10 years. We got a very tepid recovery of the real economy under Obama. And $4.5 trillion in tax cuts under Trump did not really stimulate the economy sufficiently. So fiscal policy does not give you the bang for the buck, and nor does monetary interest rate policy in late neoliberal capitalism. That's why I say, you know, monetary and fiscal policy are entering an end game as we understand it. It doesn't work the way as efficiently as it once did, which puts them, you know, the policymakers and the capitalists between a rock and a hard place. They're relying on fiscal and monetary policy, but it's not working very well anymore. Yeah. I mean, that was what, you know, Inflation Reduction Act, these other three acts, $1.65 trillion, were really all about, you know. Throw a lot of money at businesses and maybe they'll invest. And that will create jobs, right? And increase productivity, because businesses have not been investing enough in capital equipment to generate productivity. Productivity coming out of COVID has been flat and contracting for the first time in like 40 years. They got to get productivity up, right? And that's why they're throwing, you know, $1.65 trillion at businesses, hoping that they will invest and that they will then hire people and generate more productivity. Because if productivity collapses, it puts a big pressure on what's called unit labor costs, which are a function largely of productivity. If productivity collapses, the cost of producing a unit of product, of output, rises, and businesses then pass that on in inflation. That's another reason why we got chronic inflation, because productivity has collapsed. Right? And they're trying to stimulate it with these three bills. You know, productivity collapse and supply chain problems and price gouging by monopolistic corporations and landlords and so forth. All that is why inflation is chronic. And to say that you're going to bring it down by laying people off who work in services industry, you know, it's focusing on the wrong source of the problem. Right. Anyway, that's the hype with the Inflation Reduction Act going on right now. And all the Democrat policymakers and polls are jumping in. Robert Reich is touting the Inflation Reduction Act. And Paul Krugman, New York Times, touting it as the, you know, the best thing since French bread. So they're all joining, you know, and you're going to see a lot more of this hype and spin going on throughout the whole next election cycle, right? But it's mostly lies and misrepresentation about the effects of this stuff. But I guess, if you tell lies long enough and you get enough people joining in, that people might believe it. But polls show people aren't believing it. People, what is it, 30-some% think the policies on the economy are working under Biden, 32%, something like that. People don't buy it. Where the rubber hits the road, it's not such a pretty sight, the economy, right? Yeah. So let's move on here a little bit. HRC, Hillary, as I said, also hyping this thing. Oh, the best turbocharged. I had a laugh when I read that. Oh, it's turbo. IRA is turbocharged manufacturing. That's why it's contracted 9 months in a row in the U.S., right? Okay. All right. So that's my take on the IRA fiesta event here and Bidenomics and the tour, and we'll keep poking our finger at all this hype and spin about economic policies of the Biden administration. Okay, as I said last week, I also wanted to start a discussion about exploitation of labor. And to try to understand exploitation under neoliberalism, right? Important. Because exploitation, however you want to define it, has increased significantly under the neoliberal form of capitalism here since the late 70s, early 80s. I wrote an article some time ago about the changing character of exploitation in production and exchange here, an excerpt which I'm going to post on my blog, jackrasmus.com, to show that exploitation of labor has increased. Well, what's exploitation? Exploitation is someone's got to exploit someone being exploited, right? What does exploiting mean? It means that you're taking more and more of what they had from them for yourself. That's essentially what exploitation is, right? A greater share being extracted from somebody. When capitalist, neo-colonial, and so forth exploit other countries, what they're doing is they're taking the natural resources from those countries at a very cheap price, paying those countries taking the value from those resources and making money off them, right? By the way, to digress a little bit here on that question, exploitation at a national level, and then we'll talk about exploitation at a production level here, workers in the U.S. exploitation versus other countries' exploitation. What's going on in Northwest Africa? Right? The country there, Niger, which is an area called the Sahel, S-A-H-E-L, right? Sahel, and countries like Burkina Faso and Mali and Chad and Algeria, southern Algeria and Libya, right? That's, right there in the desert, the Sahara Desert, or dry areas around the desert. Those countries are very rich in certain natural resources, and Niger is a country right in the middle of that area. Niger is a major source for European uranium, right? Now you got to remember, this was the area that France had colonial domination for a long time. Even economic colonial, neo-colonial domination until recently. Those countries are beginning to break away and become part of you know, independent Africa here, break away from the French Empire. Now, you got to understand that France produces over half of its electricity from nuclear power. You know, of all the countries in Europe, it is the most dependent on nuclear energy. And it gets most, the majority of its pure uranium from Niger, right? And Niger, military coup took over and said, no, you know, you've been ripping us off at very low prices paying for our uranium. We want the full market price for our uranium. And, you know, there was politicians here that were playing games with you, France, and we just threw them out of office. And, you know, we want our full value here. The same thing happened in Mali and elsewhere. And so, France can't control its economic empire any longer in the Sahel. It's a big crisis because France is now trying, and the U.S., along with the U.S., is trying to get other African countries to invade Niger. That's particularly Nigeria. Niger and Nigeria are two different countries. Nigeria is part of this pro-European grouping of countries in the area called ECOWAS. So far, Niger is just threatening and not attempting to invade because Algeria and other countries in the area said they're going to come on the side of Niger if you do, and then we got a full-scale regional war in Africa. But that thing is developing. We'll see what happens. The U.S. sent its number one neocon, Victoria Nuland, who recently got promoted in the State Department, to talk sense to the Niger military and who took over. And, of course, she was thrown out. You got to remember, though, that the U.S. has a big military base in Niger, over 1,000 troops there, I think. Remains to be seen whether the U.S. will step in on behalf of France, because France can't control what's left of its pitiful economic empire. The French military is really atrophied, almost as bad as the British military. They're a joke in military terms, more dependent on the U.S. than ever before. And you got to remember, the U.S. A couple of years ago set up what it called an African command in anticipation that the Europeans' hegemony in certain areas of Africa would dissipate, which, of course, it is, right? So what we're talking about is exploitation of natural resources, enriching the wealth of capitalists in Europe and, of course, in the U.S. Exploitation occurs at that level, but it also occurs at a production level in the U.S. and elsewhere, too, capitalist exploitation. And it's the same principle. It's not paying the workers who create the wealth more or a legitimate share of that wealth creation, right? Or reducing their share of that wealth creation. That's exploitation. Paying them less, right? And or extracting more wealth even, and keeping their payments at a fixed level, right? Wages are the payments to the workers. You know, profits are the payments to the capitalists. You know, increase profits, keep wages frozen, or actually reduce them in certain ways. That's possible, too, in real terms. And that's what exploitation is. And if you look at exploitation at the production level in the U.S., it's intensified significantly under neoliberalism. How has that occurred? Well, in a whole number of ways. One is the increase in productivity, in other words, generating output and therefore sales annually, is all taken by the capitalists. They assume all the gains and they hold wages at the same level, right? And that's what's occurred. If you look at the wages of production and non-supervisory workers in the U.S., there's about like 110 million of production non-supervisory workers, thereabouts, maybe a little more. 110 million of them, their wages, adjusted for inflation, have not increased since 1982. Since 1982. No real wage gains when adjusted for inflation. In nominal terms, in other words, if you don't adjust it for inflation, yeah, wages have increased, but the spending power have not increased. In other words, the real wages, the real wealth has not increased for workers, 110 million workers in this country. And to the extent you got inflation accelerating, real wages contract. And that's been occurring, of course, since COVID. It's not simply that wages are not increasing anymore. They're actually going backwards in the last 2 years under Biden. Real wages are contracting. Yeah. Of course, Biden doesn't talk about that when he hypes, you know, his policies. So real wages, real wealth gains by a massive core of the working class in this country has been stagnant at best and declining. Well, that's why, one reason why, the wealthy 1% has gotten even more wealthy. They're keeping all the gains from productivity. I mean, it's very clear. You look at the Economic Policy Institute data, productivity, until recently, till COVID, was, on average rising about 1.5%, 2% per year. Right, 30 some years, right? Well, if workers were getting their share of that productivity, their real wages would be rising, appropriately, but it's not. So, management capitalists have kept all the gains from productivity. Yeah, that's one way of measuring exploitation, right? One way. There's a number of ways. That's one way. And if you look at every time we've had a serious recession in the last 30 years, coming out of the recession, you got some gain in GDP economic growth coming out of the recession. Productivity picks up coming out of the recession, and therefore more wealth is generated. Well, if you look at the 1%, the wealthiest 1% in corporate America, how much of that net GDP growth coming out of recession have they captured for themselves? GDP measures the wealth that's been created, and you adjust it for inflation. You get real wealth created GDP, right? It's not perfect, but it's the only measure we got of that estimation. And if you look at that, coming out of the 1991 recession, the wealthiest 1% gained 45% of all the wealth created in the 1990s after the 91 recession was ended. Okay. Then we had another recession in 2001 under George Bush, and we had a recovery from that recession 2002 and after. How much did the wealthiest 1% keep of the wealth, GDP wealth generated, the net increase? Right? 58%. So it went from 45 to 58%. And then after the 2008-09 crash and recession, we had a recovery in GDP and wealth creation. How much did the wealthiest 1% households get of that net gain in GDP? 92%. So coming out of every recession, the wealthier grabbing a bigger share of the recovery. Now, we don't know what the share is coming out of the COVID recession, which would be 2021-2022, right? Actually, 2022 being the first full year, half of 2020. We don't know yet, but, it could be as high as the Obama recovery of 92%. That's why I wrote a book back in 2012. I could see this coming. It was called Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. Pluto Press, you know. Check it out if you're interested in that particular piece of history. I predicted what was going to happen. And, of course, it did. The recovery was a weak recovery, but to the extent it was, the wealthy 1% got nearly all of it. Now, these statistics are, you know, the 1% share are available publicly. There's this very good economist at UC Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez, S-A-E-Z, who created this database called the ELSA ELSA database, looking at the income shares, the wealth shares of the 1% versus the rest of us, and the 0.1% of households, right? And 0.01% wealthiest households, right? So we can now see how much the 1% get. For years, for decades, the government, U.S. government, would not do that. They only broke it down into 20th percents, you know, 5/20th percentiles, 5th percentiles, so they could cover up what the 1% were getting. But, you know, this economist, Saez, he broke it down. He got some government statistics, and he broke it down and showed that the 1% were getting a greater share. And by the way, you know, this prior statistics I just gave you, 45% of the gain for the 1% in the 90s, 58 under Bush, 92 under Obama. Those all come from Science's ELSA database. It's all public record, and his methodology is all spelled out. I mean, it's good economics. You know, there's not a lot of good mainstream economics, but that was something well done, right? So exploitation, we can see at the production level in the U.S., we can see exploitation in terms of productivity sharing, who's keeping it all, right? We can see exploitation in terms of who gets the national income generated by GDP and recoveries from recessions, right? And that, you know, illustrates what's going on as well. We can see it in real wages not rising. You know, O'Brien's running around saying, oh, wages have risen 4%, you know, under my my regime here, particularly in the last year, 4% wage. That's nominal wage. That's not adjusted for inflation, by the way. And if, you know, inflation is more than 4%, like 6% in services, that means in a net national aggregate terms, even not adjusted for inflation, somebody is not doing as well. But that 4% inflation is not really 4% for the working class, you see, in this country, at least the massive bulk of the working class. Because if you look at who's getting the 4%, it's skewed to the very top 10% of the labor force. They're getting more than 4%. Which means somebody's got to get less than 4% to average out the 4%, right? And also, to some extent, in those states that have raised minimum wage at the bottom of this wage structure, the bottom 10%, they've gotten 4% or more, okay? But it's in the middle. If the bottom is getting some boost in some states, you know, where they have state minimum wage laws, not federal minimum wage, but if the bottom's getting a boost more than four, and the top is really where it's skewed, then those in the middle, the core, the working class, you know, the median, they're going backwards, you know, or they're stagnant, or they're well below 4%, right? So that's exploitation. That's exploitation, right? Then, you know, you can look at exploitation in terms not just wages, but what about benefits? What about benefits, right? I mean, those are payments to workers, right? Benefits. What about benefits? Is there any what's going on in terms of the distribution of benefits. Well, let's look at health benefits. What's happening in the last 40 years is the cost of those benefits is being shifted to workers themselves, right? Health insurance cost shifting has been going on. Dependents coverage is dropped by a lot of companies. So workers either have to pay for it or they don't get the benefits for their dependents, right? Even premiums, their share of the premiums for the workers, you know, companies usually pay part and workers are required to pay part of the monthly premiums. That's gone up. Even for non-dependents, for the workers themselves, deductibles has gone up. This is one of the areas that's really a shame here. Deductibles, even on the insurance plans, $2,000, $5,000 a year deductible. Well, I mean, you got to have cancer or heart attack to get any kind of a payment from them. Insurance companies and co-pays have gone up and coverage has declined, certain procedures exempted, which is a kind of hidden cost increase, right? So this has been going on, cost shifting. That's exploitation as well. You know, the whole principle of exploitation is taking away some of the payments or compensation or wealth in wages of the worker, and pocketing it, you, the capitalist management, pocketing it instead. And that's been a drift going on over time, compensation. There's also another aspect of exploitation and production that you want to talk about, and it's what's called secondary exploitation. Well, what do you mean by secondary? Primary is, whatever you're paid, I'm going to, I, the capitalist, I'm going to keep more of it, right? I'm going to take it away from you, and I'm going to keep more of it, right? Well, secondary is, okay, I'm going to pay you your wage, even though it's, below the cost of living and so forth. I'm going to pay you the wage, and then I'm going to take it back somehow. Well, how do they take it back? Debt and interest. In debt the worker, and then the interest payments are something that the worker is going to have to pay on the debt, which is really, think about it from the management capitalist point of view, is really a claim by them on future wages. I'm going to take some of your future wages here in interest payments, right? Inflation, the same thing. I'm going to raise prices and take back the wages you got to some extent. Well, we had a report here, credit card debt over $1 trillion. Yeah. Increasing faster than ever before. $1 trillion. 24% increase in credit card debt, I think, in just the last year. Or 24 million. I'm not sure. 24% of 24 million. A billion, excuse me. Billion. Credit card debt's over $1 trillion now. Student debt, $1.75 trillion. Going up, by the way, because interest rates have gone up and the charge on new interest on student debt is going to be between 6 and 8%, right, as of July. Auto debt is over $1.5 trillion. Mortgage debt is $12.4 trillion. $19 trillion if you include multifamily homes. Right, and then you got personal debt, loan debt, installment loan debt, medical debt. Right. By the way, 5 million households are behind on payments now on their mortgages. Mortgage rates are over 7% and going higher. Total, as of second quarter 2023, total debt, household debt is over $17 trillion and increased 8% over the past year. That's a $17 trillion compared to 2004 when it was $6 trillion. So their households are loading up on debt, $10, $11, $12 trillion in the last couple of decades, and they got to pay interest on that, and interest rates going up. And that's really a claim on future wages. In other words, we're going to take back, whoever loaned you the money, you're going to take back part of the wages you got paid and you took on excess debt because the wages weren't enough to maintain your standard of living, right? And then we got wage theft, outright wage theft, companies not paying people what they're supposed to be paid, overtime pay, minimum wage, and so forth. That's where it's hundreds, tens of billions of dollars, maybe hundreds of billions every year, wage theft going on. That's an example of taking back the wages you were paid or supposed to be paid after they got paid. Exploitation is not paying you what you're worth in the first place, keeping you down, but it's also paying you and then taking you back what they paid you in different ways. So that's intensified significantly over the past year and decades, right? So exploitation is intensifying, and that means more profit is going to business and capitalist corporations and less to workers. Intensification of exploitation is going on. Now, we're just talking about this exploitation in wage terms. You know, the wage is just the market price for labor, and profits are just the market reflection of the share that capitalists keep for themselves. That share has gone up dramatically for four decades, right? While the share for workers, the wages, has been stagnant at best or gone down. Now, we're going to have an intensification, big time, of exploitation as a result of artificial intelligence. That's a whole story in and of itself that I'm, also writing a piece on AI versus the working class. I started talking about this several shows back. You know, you may want to go back to the spring and listen to my initial show about how artificial intelligence is increasing the exploitation of the working class. It will increase productivity here. You know, productivity, I said, has been flat or contracting. It's a crisis of productivity. But now AI is going to significantly reaccelerate productivity for the capitalists, but they're going to keep the lion's share of that as well, just as they have for the last 40 years. So exploitation is going to intensify because of technology and artificial intelligence. It's going to intensify what's already an intense, multi-form structure of how wealth is taken from the working class in so many different ways and concentrated among the 1% households, their corporations and institutions. So just as you can have exploitation of workers in other countries and their natural resources and markets, you can have exploitation here at home intensifying as well. Okay, we'll talk about next week, Federal Reserve's Jackson Hole meeting.